The fruit of Zen practice. Practice is very clear. Water falls, someone picks it up. The rest of us watch. Grateful it wasn't us. Very clear, then we can let it go. But feeling stupid keeps it going, you know. Keeps it going.
Day and date.
Very simple. You forget. He reminds me. Okay. Third day, April 2017. Confusion is endless. Wonderful. Thank you, David. Margie likes to tell the story where I was getting excited and expansive one morning, giving a talk, and I went like this. Caught her on the cheek. Got enlightened, never looked back. Recently I've been reviewing the draft of a book by a young friend of ours who's a Sangoma in the Khoza tradition, a white South African. Some of you may know him, I think. And he's been a friend of Charlotte's for many years, stays with her. But one of the interesting things about the book, which I found a lovely book, despite my kind of hesitations about his tradition, I was disarmed. I was very grateful. But one thing that really struck me was how suffering was part of his path. For years as a young man he was kind of lonely and sick, chronically ill. It was one thing after another, and a real kind of loner, felt displaced, didn't belong anywhere. Couldn't share his life with people, really. And it was during that time he came and stayed at Poplar Grove. They have this neat way of doing things. He dreams of this place and then he arrives. Just not much one can say about it. Okay. I dreamt about you. Okay, well, come in then. but But yeah, and during his stay, it was quite interesting. But he was always not coping, and always feeling this and feeling that, and excusing himself from everything. And eventually, we couldn't really cope. At some point, we had to say, "We can't look after you." Our own children were just growing up then, and we felt we couldn't really help. He would have to go and stay somewhere else. I wish now I'd been able to help him more, but I wasn't really able to. But what then happened was that his his illness was given a kind of meaning in the Sangoma tradition. Suddenly he met somebody who said, "This is why you are ill, or this is what your illness is about, or this is what your illness is telling you." And it was just, I think, a miraculous moment for him to suddenly find someone saying, "Yeah, that's wonderful, you've been sick, this is why." And that's what really happened. In his story, he dreamed of a certain house in the township of one of the townships of Grahamstown. And one of the Sangoma elders who was there had a dream about a young white man coming to meet her and so on. And so they came together. And it makes a nice story too. But suddenly he was seen. Suddenly he was heard. Suddenly everything kind of had a place and a context. And that recognition just changed his life. And then he embarked on about a 10-year apprenticeship, I think. Very great commitment from his side, and learning Khoza and anyway, it's a lovely story. Just, and great generosity from the other side, people who had very little, lived in very humble circumstances, just being endlessly hospitable. And all they asked of him was commitment from his side and a lot of brandy, which they used semi-ceremonially. But it was just, for those of us that known him, it was just a wonderful turning in his life. It was great. And great sympathy. So it struck me that if we look at our own practice, if we take standard Buddhist teachings, the first thing that strikes us, they say life is suffering, or there is suffering in life, or there is suffering. And I suddenly thought of it perhaps in the light of John's story in his book, that our task is not, as we often perceive it to be, to kind of end suffering so that we can get enlightenment. It's more to do with finding a meaning for our suffering, giving it a context, giving it a wider container. to include it somehow. We have an extraordinarily instant kind of response of suffering and the end of suffering. That's what the Buddha said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. And then we turn them into opposites. And we've got a duality right there. Boom. Suffering, end of suffering. So end of suffering equals nirvana, enlightenment, whatever word you use, means that suffering ends. So let's go for it, you know. But it's vastly more subtle than that. That's a kind of magazine response. Yeah. Which we succumb to because we want to do our best in this life. You know, when Fair Lady or whatever it is says how to get rid of stress or 5 steps to happiness, we open it greedily, devour it, probably find it isn't terribly helpful, but we're trying to make the best of a thing of our life, so we'll have a peep at it anyway. You know, same like the Buddhist magazines from come in the post. Wonderful. How to have the perfect sit, you know. How to be a bodhisattva, how to get rid of anger, how to be so on and so forth. Those magazines also have their celebrity columns. What this Rinpoche did, you know. Rinpoche's nanny confesses, and so on. Tells all. Tales from the meditation booth. Anyway, right? We're trying to make this life work, so we'll take any help we can get. But that's the kind of especially the more we think about it, the sense of opposites, immediately one excludes the other. So it's kind of a trap almost built into the Buddhist teaching that that suffering is the opposite of enlightenment, and that we must get enlightenment. So we immediately start measuring, we start hoping and dreaming and feeling unworthy, whatever it is. So the various ways of dealing with it, I think some traditions say, not in this lifetime, mate. Okay. Okay. Come back 20 lifetimes and then one can relax a bit. Okay. Okay. I don't have to. Okay. This is not going to be a problem I need to deal with now. Put it off with clearing the loft and so on. It's like, not yet. Not now, not here. Zen says, only here, only now. Only here, only now. To do that, we have to take the idea of enlightenment as the opposite of suffering, and we have to allow it to drop. So enlightenment, etc., whatever words you use for it, whatever the end of suffering is, as an idea it has to drop. In theory, that's not difficult. You made the idea, so you can drop it. You made the idea of enlightenment, you're holding it, so you drop it. In practice, of course, we know that things don't work quite so neatly, which is part of what we call suffering, holding on, tightening, contracting. One of the responses to this kind of scenario of suffering and enlightenment sort of has come over the last day or so with your help, wittingly or otherwise, is that it's not so much attacking suffering, as it were, our difficulties. I'm a bad Zen student, I'm a bad person, I'm intolerant, I'm this, I'm that, or whatever it is, one thing. I'm bored to death sitting on my cushion. Yeah, what can I do? How do I deal with this? The kind of magazine response, I suppose. But once we are willing to embrace right here, or only here and only now, and once we allow ourselves just to simply be taken up in this practice, then the wider container arises. The greater life, a more open vision, and even though that comes and goes itself, like everything, it changes the perspective and the context for our difficulties. So it's not so much how can I be a better person or a kinder person or a better Zen student or a better husband or whatever it is, but rather when I find this radiance that is available, that is, that I can be part of, that kind of difficulty and that kind of thinking about the difficulty change fundamentally. They dissolve in a sense, or at least their knottedness dissolves. So, two things about suffering. One is, it's not as if we have to sort of fight it, as if it's the enemy in order to attain enlightenment, etc. But it's rather that it's part of this whole life that we're living. And when we, in those moments when we're part of that greater life, our response to suffering is not one of a problem to be conquered, but something that allows compassion to arise naturally because we know how it feels. We know how it feels. So that compassion just transforms. It is enlightenment, etc., itself. So, in our retreat practice, that's what we do. We just are here. We allow these moments of grace, of just loveliness to become part of us. And in the doing of that comes the acceptance of all the suffering and difficulties in our life. And the use of that in this life for others. So that's, I just find that wonderfully encouraging for myself. Yeah. Makes me grateful. So it doesn't matter what you think of, what you think's right or wrong, or you've got these habits and these tendencies and this background and that body and all of that stuff. When we suddenly just accept the sitting here and listening and sitting here and talking as this moment in its fullness, and all of that just drops off. Just drops off. So all you have to do in this practice, very simple, here it comes now. This is the magazine article you've been waiting for. You just have to pay your deposit. Come here on time. When the gong goes, come and sit. Sit still. Laugh at the teacher's jokes. Be willing to be foolish and shining in interview. And eat and sleep. That's it. Okay. That's it. It's all we need. All we need. And all the kind of teachings, the koans in particular, are just aiming at reminding us the whole time about the fullness of this moment, the fullness of the life beyond thinking, beyond duality, beyond opposite. And it's always, we find it where we are. We can only find it where we are. The jewel in the dung heap, they say. Traditional phrase. Jewel. Just don't forget the dung heap, okay? Dung heap's part of the story. So, I've got another story for you today. It's from a koan collection called Entangling Vines. Wonderful. Mainly wonderful because it doesn't have any commentary. So one's got to kind of find it. And this story is called Beijing's New Paddy. And this isn't the Beijing I was talking about yesterday and the day before. Beijing Huihai, I think his name is. Disciple of Ma Tzu, if you like that sort of information. Early Zen masters, all of these. Baizhang was the heir of the man we were speaking of yesterday. His name was Nipan, because he always read the Nipan Sutra, what they call the Nirvana Sutra. I've never read it. Some ancient text. I never had the courage to. But he was called Nipan because he always read that. It's a kind of tradition in these kind of stories that you get called after your habits or your sutras or your mountain. So Margie would probably be called Who Done It, Osler. Anyway, that sort of thing. Anyway, this is called Beijing's New Paddy. Beijing Weizhang Nipan of Hongzhou. Anyway, said to the monks, if you clear a new rice paddy for me, I will explain to you the great principle. The monks went off to clear the rice paddy. After clearing the new paddy, the monks returned and asked the master to explain the great principle. And the master held out his hands. Great story. Let me read it to you again. And Nipan said to the monks, if you clear a new rice paddy for me, I will explain to you the great principle. After clearing the new paddy, probably takes about 3 months. After clearing the new paddy, the monks returned and asked the master to explain the great principle, and the master shrugged and held out his two hands. Okay. Okay. So during interviews today, we'll just have a look and see if clearing the rice paddy itself is enough. Whether there's something outside of what we're doing that we have to look for, or whether we can find it inside the sweat and toil of our work, whatever we're up to. I hope to be much quicker today so that we can all sit together in the afternoon. Let's just sit together for a minute.